We had the admiration for the Tank Corps, I think. I don't know of any infantry soldier who wanted to go and join the Armored Corps. He didn't like getting into a box and the chance of being fried in it, you know. I quite agreed with him. I wouldn't have gone to the Tank Corps or anything. But we had admiration for him. They considered themselves a little an elite body, I think. But we got along pretty well with them.
And you would have had what? You had six hussars there.
We trained chiefly with the British tanks, and then latterly with I think one or two exercises with the hussars and our own armor. The chief difficulty with tanks, of course, was always in communication. How do you attract the attention of a tank? In Normandy on D-Day, we were stuck. At least the C Company had been stuck, and I was coming up behind. And I knew there were tanks coming up behind us, and there was a target where there was a nest of Germans that were holding us up with a machine gun. And I tried to attract the attention of the tank. How do you do it? If they don't see you, then what do? If you get around the front, you like to get shot at. So as you go and bang on the side of the tank, I actually took a rifle and banged on the side of the tank until he opened the door, the manhole at the top, and came out. That was Darcy
Murphy. Did
they
have a phone in the back?
Pardon?
Did they have a phone in the back for directing fire?
Well, not these anyway.
Not these
no.
ones.
But that was one of the difficulties. That was one that we tried to solve at these various exercises. But we did exercise with armor. And of course, there was always this business of digging slit trench and then cowering in it and letting the tank roll over, just to prove that two things. One, that you should always make a slit trench very narrow and very quite deep. And the other is that the tank couldn't get at you. When he straddled. And then, of course, all that was blown sky high because our tanks then began to be equipped with the manholes where they could drop anti-personnel grenades down as they passed over the German slits.
So they didn't say that at first?
No. The troops, of course, had a lot of live ammo training.
That's the only way to train, is that correct?
Well, yes, I think so. I went up in January of 1941, the depth of winter. I was sent up with another officer, the Bren gun carrier officer, Lieutenant Weiler. And we went up to what was the first battle school ever. It was run by the Imperial General Staff. It was a British school. And it was staffed chiefly by young officers who'd served in North Africa. It was up in Yorkshire in the depths of winter, snow on the ground. You did everything on the double. You ran from your sleeping quarters down to the mess hall and you doubled and back. And the whole theme was this battle training, battle school training, where time was no longer on our side. This is the theme. We've got to get cracking, we've got to get busy. So everything was done on the double, so on and so on. And conditions were made as tough as possible. You were dressed in sort of dungarees, boiler suits, and these were all officers. And you then became a platoon, and each section you carried the old huge anti-tank rifle and your Bren guns and your rifles and grenades, and then you went out into the snowy fields and groves and forests, and they put you through various exercises. What do you do now? There's the situation, platoon holding you up here, platoon strength. What do you do? Really, right on the strut, you must make your plan and proceed. And this was excellent. Then you went on assault courses where they fired, this is the first time they ever did it, live ammo over your heads and explosive charges under your feet practically. And this was the first assault course. crossing the River Tee up to here in water with a rifle and then climbing up a cliff with the aid of rope and so on and so on. And I almost died. I'm not a very strong person, but I managed to survive. I don't know where I ranked on, if there's any ranking as to grading. I don't think I'd rank very high, but I managed to survive. And because it was the new course, there were about, 15 Canadians on it, and all the rest were British. They were trying out ideas. One was to make us not blench if we saw blood. And we were taken into a small hut, and the doctor was there, and he had a Florence flask in his hand full of red material, and it was blood all right. He smashed against a whitewashed wall, you see, and then they'd observe you to see whether you went from this way or not, or whether you had to go outside to vomit. They slaughtered sheep in front of you and the ventrals and things like that. Well, this only lasted, I think, one course, and they realized that there's no effect at all, you know. And another one they tried was a hate business, hate proposition, you know, hate the Germans. Look at the Germans then, and this is the atrocities, pictures, movies, and so on. It might have gone over with other troops, but the Canadians simply sort of shrugged and said, what the hell, laughed at it, you know. What are they trying to do? We know about the Germans, we know about atrocities, and this is propaganda, so they stopped that after that first serial. But it went on, and then the Canadians also started these battle schools, and we sent people down to instruct.
You get in for Normandy. You're on the boat for how long? 2 days?
We went, invasion was on the 6th of June. We went on the night of the day of the 24th, yes. And then there's the 24-hour postponement.
You board the ship on the 4th?
On the 4th, yes. I think I'm
stayed
correct.
On board. Postponement, and you stayed on during the 5th.
Yeah.
How many guys sick? Not a seasickness and things?
Well, not right in there. They're okay because they're just moored in the Solent behind the Isle of Wight, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And on the evening before D-Day, you know, it's on the evening of the 5th when we were going to start out, we were issued, at that time incidentally, we were issued with the maps of the French coast, but still under code names. We were also issued little pink seasick pills to be taken if you felt any nausea at all. We were also issued with paper bags, vomit, marks, so and so. But there was no seasickness even after we started out on the crossing, because we were in the big landing ship. And it wasn't until the men disembarked from the ships into the assault craft, in the small craft, and it was rough on the morning of D-Day that you got some certain amount of seasickness. I'd taken my pill and then promptly lost it because I probably vomited, and that was it. And after that, I was okay. But there was a certain amount of seasickness, but not very much.
Did you have any fear that you were going to be swept back?
Well, be met with hail of fire and things like that. I can't remember that much. I was a little apprehensive. I think everybody's a little apprehensive. And people say, were you frightened? I'd say, sure, I was frightened, you know. But I don't think we anticipated. Well, we did anticipate more than we got, there's no doubt about it. And this is where the various aspects of training in England came to the fore. One thing, we were used to being in assault craft. We were used to landing on a beach. We were used to plunging over into water and struggling ashore. We were used to going to certain areas and finding exits from the beaches and so on. And I think while there was a certain amount of apprehension, I think there was a certain amount of excitement which overcame that apprehension.
What did it feel like to look up? All
the
ships behind you and
beside you. Well, it's a tremendous sight because the whole invasion fleet had gathered in the Solent and along the coast. So that evening, the evening before D-Day, looking out, you couldn't see really if there's one ship was there, the other was there, and another was here, so that you couldn't practically see water, if you know what I mean. It was an artificial horizon of ships. And then when we started out, and that, of course, was a masterpiece of planning and logistics, with the priorities, how the ships would move out, where they would go. I remember looking out, you know, as we were proceeding towards the French coast, and there in front of us on either side were minesweepers sweeping the pathway and leaving little bobbing red buoys and lights like this, and our vessel coming down. And then off there would be maybe a screen of destroyers, and back here a big battleship and monitors, things you'd never seen before, you know, floating gun platforms, that's all they were, and all types of craft. It was amazing.
Did you see Mulberry at all?
That was the artificial dock. No, I never saw any part of Mulberry, but I did see part of Pluto, pipeline under the ocean, limited. But I didn't know what it was. In the Solent, there were huge reels, like the same big reels the telephone company, etc., winds their cable on when they're laying it, standing up, floating in the water. And a lot of big black rubber pipe wrapped around, it seemed like rubber pipe anyways, there. And these things were just floating in what the hell is that? But this is obviously the Pluto. Because as soon as the channel was clear and there was a reception point on the other side, they started to lay the, so as to pump the gas and petrol across the channel and other things.
What was it like when you hit the beach?
Well, my own experience was that we were lowered from the Queen Emma, which is our landing ship infantry, and hit the water, cast off, and the assault craft is in charge of a sub-lieutenant, I think, and a petty officer of the Navy. And this was Royal Navy. They'd taken over this Dutch liner, the Queen Emma. Most of the battalion was over on the Prince Henry, which was a Canadian ship. But my particular serial, it was in there. We hit the water, and it was pretty rough, and we headed in. And we looked around, there were maybe 10, 15 of these assault craft all around you, and then there was a little a small landing ship, the type that had the gangways down the near the bow, not like the big landing ship in infantry. I forget what they called them. But there aboard this was the maybe a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander, Royal Navy, with a loud hailer saying, "All right, number so and so, you're getting onto the line. Okay, proceed at half speed," and so on. Loud hailer, just like that. Just like a shepherd with his flock, you know, sort of thing. As we approached, you could see the coast, and one of the most awesome sights I ever saw was what looked like a huge, it would be a landing craft tank with a superstructure in towards the rear in this open space, you see. But mounted on this, obviously, were hundreds of rockets like this. And just as I was watching, they let go maybe about 50 of them all at once, like this, and up she went. You could hear the bombardment going on from the Royal Navy and American ships, etc., out in the channel, big stuff going over. As we got in, we'd been told about it and shown in lots of aerial photographs, of course. I forgot to mention that. We got a lot of aerial photographs of the beaches, of these chevaux de frise businesses, these pieces of girder steel, T-beam and I-beam, cross pieces this way, and then attached to them a landmine, you see. And these were, and then there was barbed wire. As we went forward towards pretty well, I would think, the exact landing place that we were supposed to go, which again is a marvel of navigation by the Royal Navy and other navies. It was obvious we couldn't get thing because we were a little late, and the tide had started to recede, and so these things were exposed, you see, which may be a good thing. You could see where certain craft had hit them and been blown. So our sub-lieutenant decided that he would back off and go around. We were under fire, of course, at this time, because he saw over here a landing ship tank or a landing ship vehicle or something which had been hit a mine and sunk. So he figured if we went alongside that, we'd be sheltered, so on. And he took us alongside, we clambered aboard this, went forward on this thing to the ramp in the front, and jumped off in about 8 feet of water, I would think.
Well, under fire.
Under fire, yes. About 8 feet of water. I remember going down, touching bottom, still holding my map case and, you know, the whole bit, and sort of touching bottom and then bobbing up, making a few sort of frantic business, and then I could touch with my toes and waded ashore. There was no hesitation on the part of the boatload. They were all behind, either ahead of me or behind me. And we hit the beach, and there was a certain amount of fire, a certain amount of, I would think, mortar fire hitting the beach. A certain amount of stuff you could feel going overhead. But just to the right was the beach exit that we knew should be there and was there. And although it was marked Minen as being mined, we were being told that it was clear. I don't know how they knew, although there was all sorts of tales about British intelligence had sent men ashore, frogmen, etc., like that. It was one most likely not correct story of the fact that they'd brought in a midget submarine and a man had got out in a rubber suit to decorate the seaweed, and he'd stood backing out with the tide and taking pictures of the shore from the distance. It's quite possible. I believe anything about the British, especially in that sort of crack baiting business. We found the beach exit, and then we proceeded as quickly as possible to our rendezvous, which was in a farm yard.
Well,
they were, it was supposed to be pretty well simultaneous. In fact, some of those had got ahead of us, obviously, because they were there in La Valette when I arrived. So the matter of synchronization, in fact, I thought possibly we were a little late, but some of those might be a little later getting ashore, but there we were, the whole battalion had marshaled, so that then we reported into Colonel Cagledew to see how, say, we'd arrived, and, you know, we had so many platoons, so many men, so many casualties, as far as we could see, so on, and then waited orders to move on. It was then that I was waiting for the colonel to say, all right, A Company, move off, you know your route, etc., way to go. I looked back to the beach, and there was a sand dune down on the beach. We were about maybe 200, 300 yards from the beach by this time. And up on top of the sand dune, damn fool thing to do, shot a little armored car flying a pennant, a little yellow and red pennant. And I knew what it was because this is part of our briefing, that these were the Inns of Court Regiment, Armored Car Regiment. And their job is to go forward and see certain bridges and wait our coming, hold them. So, you know, and just this thing popped up on the dune, something went poof, and the thing just disintegrated. And I looked around, and there was a slight puff of smoke coming from the haystack over on our left. German 88 gun in there. And that's a detailed Lieutenant Clark to take it out. And he did. He took it out. And wasn't much taking out to it because they surrendered immediately and were surrounded with a German gun crew in there. But they had waited. And of course, I've always blamed myself for that, because I should have, when I saw that haystack originally, I should have immediately sent somebody over there to have a look at it. You see. Because we've been told about camouflaged haystacks and everything else. Mm-hmm. In fact, later I looked at the aerial photograph, and there was that haystack showing up on the aerial photograph. I should have marked it. I should have known better. about 12 years, 15 years ago, I was over in Britain. I found the Inzercourt Regiment headquarters and a museum, and I apologized.
How difficult were the conditions? Was the terrain and things? Was it helping you, against you, or just neutral?
As soon as we were off the beaches, there was less fire, of course, because the Germans were concentrating artillery and mortar fire right on the beaches themselves, which is very wise, of course. But I don't think they were getting the casualties they figured. We then proceeded in a deployed fashion on the route we would be chosen on the map, towards our first objective, which was a small village called Amazon or something, by code name, I think it was. It was mostly through a slightly wooded area, some fields, some crops, road. We had no particular difficulty at all. We began to get under artillery fire, because they now figured that there'd be enough ashore, we should be on. They were hitting the intersections of roads and so on and so on. And this took a little, and a couple of men went to ground, just stayed there, and you had to say, all right, come on, there's nothing. You can hear these things coming, you know when they're coming, and you know where they're going to hit, just listen. You know, and up they would get, and they went forward. Because this is the first time they'd been under artillery fire, which is entirely different than, you know, small arms fire and things like that.
How were Canadian troops used, in your opinion? Were they used properly? Was your unit used properly?
Yes. I think they were wise, one, to choose the 3rd Division, because we were most highly trained. I think we had maybe, due to the fact of internal troubles in the 2nd Division, even before it ever got to England, in part, and NDF, the room was fitted. So I think that was a good choice. And I think we were used properly. I think we were used as an assault division. And that was good. Because we had some good units in the division, some excellent units.
How did the feel of being in France finally?
Well, it was a sort of a feeling of relief. Well, here we are. Yeah. Here we are. And take it by and large, it was a case now of a certain revival of that fervor, but there was also a more professional spirit. And certainly as time went on, in 6 months' time, the Canadian Division, and certainly I can speak for the battalion, Canadian Scottish, they were professional soldiers. So much of what would be they'd been used to saying, all right, do this, do that. Mm-hmm. They now did on their own.
Even criticism levied at the Canadians in general about the police business or the police road and the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Canadians didn't close off the gap quick enough, as leveled by some Americans. They were there.
Well, I can't speak personally, but from what I know of Phillies, I was hit before Phillies.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right, but I'd like to mention that. To begin with, when you say, were the Canadians used properly? Yes, I think they were. They were given the toughest corner of that invasion. Other than the fiasco at Monmouthan Beach with the Americans, We were given the toughest road to hold. That was to go right through and cut the Caen, was it Cherbourg, rail line, and then proceed to take Caen, that was it. And that's where the Germans concentrated their forces. Without being derogatory about the Americans, than the beaches, which of course, in my opinion, was poor planning. The reason we didn't have the casualties on our beaches was because of good planning, I'm sure. you know, dispersal of troops and so on, so everybody knew what they were doing, so mm-hmm. on and so on. And then the Americans were held up quite a bit. Their drop, their parachute drop, etc., was mucked up. They were landing all over the place. And that again was either poor planning or something.
Yeah.
And in other words, they made a lot of difficulties themselves. When they broke out, they were good, Patton and all the rest, you know, mm-hmm. big circle. But by this time, the Germans had concentrated all their armor and all their strength on our corner. So in the defense of Caen and the railway. And this is what made it particularly tough. And the Canadians took Caen, and then they proceeded, and this business of the Gap, Falaise, here again, the Americans made the circle around while the Canadians were engaging at Falaise and holding the German armor there. This is the point. In other words, we attracted, and this was part of Montgomery's plan and our own army plan, General Dempsey, whatever it was that we'd attract all the German strength on our mm-hmm. sector to give the Americans, the U.S. Army, a chance to break out and do the encircling movement. So I think that the criticism of the Canadians at Falaise is unjustified. And then again, the impetuosity of the Poles, the Polish Armored Division, didn't help in that area either.
Why was that?
I don't know. I can't remember exactly about that, but the Poles, seeing troops moving, promptly shelled them, and they were our people and that sort of thing. Rushing in.
It's really the fight, eh? That's you said you were wounded, I did find it here. You were wounded on the
8th of July?
Yep. 8th July, 44. What were the circumstances around that?
Well, we had done our... We advanced inland on D-Day, and we were quite far in when the evening fell, and then we were drawn back about 400 yards or half a mile because there was a danger of German counterattack, and they wanted to form a defended, mm-hmm. what they call a hedgehog division, a strong point. And then the next day we advanced to the village of Seckville, and overnight there, and the next day, holding with our... We didn't reach the railway line, which had been the objective for D-Day, actually. But we were within a mile of it, a half mile of it. But we were still further forward than any other unit. And then, of course, the German counterattacked on the 8th, 9th of... June, and overran the Winnipegs on the left flank. Mm-hmm. The Winnipegs were there, the right flank, and the Reginas on the left flank. And then we had to counterattack that night, evening, into Puto en Bassant, which we did successfully. And
anything you recall of those engagements at all? Anything stand out in those particular engagements?
Well, the counterattack on Puto was a good example of a hastily conceived counterattack where you had to use your initiative. The German tanks had come down and with German infantry overrun the Winnipeg positions, so that only one company really held and came right down facing us. In fact, we had tanks, Tiger tanks, coming right down our right flank. But fortunately, they stopped. Went back.
What
the Tigers? Are a very efficient tank.
Scare the hell out of you?
Yes.
Or what?
Yeah. You had to get close enough to kill them with a bazooka or something like that if you wanted to survive. But I had anti-tank guns under my command at Seckville, And the gunners, sergeant gunners, were all for letting the tank have it, you know, a distance of about 400 or 500 yards. And I said, nothing doing. For one thing, they don't know we're here. If they attack, come closer, yes, we'll see. But not at that range, because you're merely, these 8 pounders merely bounce off.
Oh, right.
Sure. And then they'd swivel their 88s, and that's when we'd have had it. As it is, they retreated. So we, in the meantime, over in my right flank of my company, there was a little pocket of Germans in a grove, and they were being a nuisance. They were sniping at us from the laterally, from the flank. So I sent a platoon over to clear them out. And it had just gone. I got orders to go to the command, the CO's O group. Arrived there, and he said that the Winnipegs had given way, and we had to put in a counterattack within an hour and a half. He hastily detailed the plan, the timing, and so on, and told us we'd have certain artillery support, and get back to your company and get cracking.
Yeah.
I got back, and of course had to send a runner over to find these platoon I'd dispatched to the right. Held a brief O group with the two remaining platoon commanders. Left somebody to pass on the word to the remaining platoon when it came in. And we proceeded. And it was up through apple orchards and wheat fields and fields full of mustard seed, you know, making. And as we were, of course, late crossing the start line, so the barrage was falling well ahead of us. On my right, that's the D Company, and in the haste, McEwen had misread his orders, so he was astride the road, whereas he should have been to the right of the road, and so I had to move over this way, but then I decided that we were late. Of course, he was one of the forward companies, so he was ahead of us. And I had to decide to support his remaining platoon up there, because they were suffering casualties up this side. And hoping that my own platoon would come up in a hurry. And we advanced through this hail of fire, and it was pretty severe, up through the orchards and up through the wheat fields and until we hit the railway line, which was the original D-Day objective. And then D Company had lost its McEwen and lost its second in command, and one of the junior lieutenants was in charge. And he was just inexperienced, of course. He was in a bit of a flap. In the meantime, I detailed my company to swing left and took my own objective in the flank, if you could call it that way, and organized both companies so they were mutually supported.
You took both companies under your command?
I took both companies under my command. And a unit of our mortars had come up, and they were doing yeoman business behind us. And we retook the both company positions, because these had been both two forward Winnipeg rifle positions. We retook them. And then we held on at Rots. We got permission to come back about 100 to 150 yards from the railway line to get a good field of fire. There was no use sitting in there, because we were under observation by the German artillery, and we were being shelled all the time. I remember that morning in the slip trench, and the Batman was over in the other slip trench, and I was talking to my second in command, Bill Matthews, discussing what was going to happen that day, etc., and what had happened the night before. And this crazy Batman, I forget his name, climbed out of his slip trench, holding a mess tin like this, and started across this shell-swept area towards us. And we were shouting at him, for God's sake, go back, come on. run, drop that thing, run. He stood in the end of our slip trench and said, here's some hot tea, sir. I thought you'd like some hot tea. Reached down, pulled into the trench, and the stuff coming down. Well, I don't know if you call that just being bloody foolish, or whether, you know, you have to admire the boy. That was his job. His job is to look after us. And he was doing that.
So you were wounded?
Well, that was months later.
Is this a truck incident, or?
Pardon?
Is this with the truck where you...
No. From Puto, we were moved over to the village of Rots, which is nearer to Kham. And our position was taken over by the Chaudière regiment of the Chaudière. I had been over to liaise with the Chaudières, along with Crofton, who was acting for the CO, and other company commanders with me, and so on, to liaise and find out how we'd make this interchange. It was decided that at 9 o'clock, it was 9:30 when it began to get dark, they would start a company from their area, and we'd start a company from our area, and they would go over and interchange, and then the next company would do the same thing, so that there'd always be sufficient strength in both places in case there was a raid. And this was all arranged, times were set up. I liaised with, it was Whiteman, not Crofton, who was there. He was acting for the colonel. And he had done the same with the colonel of the Chaudières. And absolute silence to be observed, and so on. And I went back to my area, which was a company commanded by Hugh Lapointe, Bob Lapointe, Lieutenant Governor of Quebec. And we had agreed what we were going to do. But by the time I got back, here I find Bob's company marching out. And I said, what gives? He said, well, I got an order from the colonel to march out now. And it was still light, only about 8:30, you see. I went, rushed to find Whiteman. He said, everybody's gone. Everybody's gone. Oh, ready. And so all we could do is send a dispatch rider over to our field saying, the Chaudières are on their way. And we're here, all 15 of us, holding the line. As it happened, nothing transpired. Immediately the colonel started to send our companies over quickly, right across country, and without any disregard of the secrecy or anything else, just had to get over it fast. But if the Germans had sent in a fighting patrol there, they hadn't found out, they could have come through the line. But just another case, the French-Canadian troops, they didn't give a damn for, you know, things. For instance, when they did come into that line, in the dark, by the time they got there, it was in the dark. They came in shouting and singing and so on and so on. Well, we then stayed in that position at Rots for about 3 weeks, you see, and while they keyed up this attack on Kham. And then on the morning of the 7th, I suppose, of July, we advanced northward to a village called Caron, or Bucaron. We spent the night and then marched out the next morning deploying to make the attack down towards the village called Cussy and Con and behind. And I was at this time acting second in command. I was second in command of the battalion. Colonel Cabledew was back, but Whiteman, the second in command, had been wounded. It out because our headquarters building had been shelled some time before that. And I was second in command. I had to see the last troops go, and then I proceeded with my jeep and my signaler well to the rear, and we're going down this road towards Cussy with the whole battalion deployed on either side. And I was following about just behind the two rear companies, I suppose, but on the main road, command vehicle with the CO was well ahead. And 88 shells burst began to come like this on either side of the road, like that. And I figured out, this is it. The next one is going to be here, so we'll move away from here. And I just gave the order out and turned around to cross, straight across the road, and the shell burst there, and that was it. I was hit, left chest, and so on.
How long were you?
Well, the orders were, you see, that, see, I blacked out right away. If I hadn't blacked out, I might have been able to stick it out. But the orders were that anybody wounded in that theater war up to that time, you were taken immediately out through casualty clearing station, right back. There were no real hospital set up or anything like that, right to the port, into a hospital ship, right back to England. And it doesn't matter what you had, whether it was an abscess tooth or a very serious wound, you went back, because they didn't want the area cluttered up. That's right, yeah. Cluttered up with things, yes. So by the time I was through the casualty clearing station before I regained consciousness, and back and saying I was perfectly all right, and indeed I was, a very minor wound. But there was no go onto the hospital ship back to England.
And you remained there until
I didn't. I remained there. Treated that, and that carried up, and then they discovered I had trench mouth, and I had to have dental operation. And then I got orders to, about September, to report to the Black Watch, take command of the 1st Battalion Black Watch, and the 2nd Div. And by the time I began to get ready to go and get my warrants and papers, that was canceled, and I was told to wait. And then about another month, less a couple of weeks, I was told to report to the Scottish. And I came back, got back in October, and get back in October.
And well, from that on the tape, the time is going to be pretty good for today.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.